I hate to pull this on people, but since we're such a small group, would you mind coming forward? I never like to do that to people, but since we're small, I would think I would do that.
We were just figuring you were still expecting a crowd.
Well, there might be more. This happened yesterday too. It was pretty small at first, and then some trickled in. The front row is the new back row. We have some, at the school I teach at, we have some classrooms that are in the basement with no windows. Oh. Right, exactly. So whenever I'm not using the screen, I project, if I'm in those classrooms, I'll project a picture of a window looking out over a nice meadow or something like that, just so we feel like we have a view.
But it could be better when the portables are off.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Basically a dumpster with a couple windows cut out of it. Yeah.
And our daughter teaches orchestra, and she was in one of those one year, and it was just the worst.
Yeah.
No, you have orchestra.
Orchestra in a portable classroom.
It's really a nightmare.
Yeah.
The sound, everything is awful.
Well,
there's too many kids.
Yeah, you can tell where our priorities are, huh?
Yeah.
Or where they're not, at least.
Well, it's just one year.
Well, welcome to Tuesday's.
Tuesday.
Welcome to Tuesday's
matter.
Session. Doesn't matter. Welcome to this session that we're having on this day. My name is Jeremy Myers. I teach in the religion department at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, where I also oversee their youth ministry major. So I've been asked to come to the village this week and next to talk about youth ministry, which is something I love to do, and I understand something that doesn't happen often in sessions here, which is so it makes this invitation extra special for me. And in fact, prior to becoming a professor, I was a youth minister at a couple different churches, and was on the way up here was remembering that I sort of received my call, if you will, into youth ministry here in the village 15 years ago. I was running the youth programming, the minors, junior minors programming here, and the last day I was in the village, if you were here yesterday, some of this is a repeat, so I apologize. I was running the youth program, and the last day I was here in the village, a young man cornered me and made me promise him that I would, when I got back to Minneapolis, I would contact his church and the pastor at his church because they were looking for a youth minister. So this 16-year-old boy was promising me, making me promise that I would contact his pastor to talk about a job there. And I wasn't really even thinking about going into youth ministry. I knew I wanted to work with kids, didn't know in what capacity. And so this 16-year-old wouldn't let me off the bus. He had cornered me. And I said, fine, I'll call your pastor. And I did, and I went and met with his pastor. And liked the pastor, liked the church, I liked the job description, and so I agreed to do it for 1 year. It was an interim position, and here I am 15 years later now, and I've fallen in love with this thing we call youth ministry. So it's kind of fun to be back here where, in a way, it all started for me. I want to spend some time with you today talking about practices or art forms that I think might help our congregations be more public about our faith with our young people. So I'm going to give you, briefly spend a little bit of time doing some theoretical background for you on this idea of public youth ministry. But let me go back and just show you this image. This is from a, I believe it's a community, I believe they're Ireland, community that's based around the arts and faith, where I found this painting of this text. And I just like the painting as it depicts each part of this Ezekiel text. That's the theme verse for the summer. And we'll come back to this story in a few minutes, but we'll keep this image in front of us as well. As we go, you can see the man experiencing the depth of the river as he goes, right? And yesterday we talked about, in this session, we talked about accompaniment and going, how does the church accompany its context? How do we go into the community in which we're planted and begin to realize the breadth and the depth of God's mercy and God's grace that flows beyond the temple, beyond the church. And today we'll be talking about biblical imagination. How do we go into our communities with a biblical imagination for what God is doing in those places? And how do we do that with our young people? So there are two, I would say, two major cultural shifts that happen that have created sort of a perfect storm, the perfect storm that we find ourselves in right now in terms of youth and religion. One would be the privatization of religion, post-Enlightenment, where it was no longer thought to be appropriate to be making public decisions based on faith and religion. So religion became thought of primarily as a private thing, something you do on your own, for yourself, for your own betterment. And this rather new phenomenon in the history of humanity, but it's a powerful one that deeply impacts the Christian culture today. And I think it prevents us from presenting to our young people a vibrant expression, public expression of faith. Because we automatically think faith is this private thing. And so then a lot of the public expressions of faith we see are not constructive, right? They're destructive. So that's one cultural shift. Another cultural shift really would be this emergence of adolescence as a life phase, which has not always been there, right? It's only the idea of adolescence or teenager has only been around for maybe 100 years. So again, this is a rather recent phenomenon as well. But one we just sort of assume to be a given, a normal. You know, that, oh, that's youth culture. This is the way teenagers are. Well, it's not the way teenagers have been for most of history. It's the way we've made them to be now. So we've created something that we then point to often and poo-poo it and speak poorly of it, and or we're confused by it and bewildered by it or angered by it. It's sort of our own creation, this thing called adolescence. So these are the two rather recent cultural shifts that put us in a real interesting place. We don't have a vibrant way of expressing faith publicly, and we have a very narrow, limited view of the teenager that's based primarily on biology. There are just a bunch of unpredictable, strange chemical reactions that are happening that we can't control, and you need to just sort of put your hands in the air and walk away from and let it happen, and hopefully it doesn't self-destruct, right? Or we view them as a lump of clay or a blank slate that's completely shaped by culture, media, violent video games, right? We talk about young people as though those are the only things that have any agency or power in shaping our young people. So we have a limited way of expressing faith. We have a limited understanding of the adolescent. Both of those things need to shift. If you want to hear more about how I think that can happen, I'd be happy to talk to you around the village sometime about that. For now, let me just say where I think we need to head would be towards a vocational understanding of adolescence, so not just a biological or cultural understanding of the teenager, right? It's not just raging hormones, not just a blank slate, but also a human being called by God, gifted by the Spirit of God, empowered to do God's work in this world, so that culture and biology are not the only things with agency in a young person's life, but that God's Spirit, we believe that God's Spirit is actually doing something to them. So how then does a Christian community begin to help the young person understand what God's Spirit is doing to them? But we also need to pause and ask ourselves, do we even really believe that God's Spirit is doing something to them? And I hope we would say yes. And then I hope we would find ways to help them understand that. So maybe some of this dynamism of adolescence is not just hormones. Maybe it's God working in them and disturbing them, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by shifting towards a vocational understanding of the adolescent. Yes?
How recent did you say this development is?
Adolescence?
This privatization. Last 100 years, did you say?
Adolescence is only about 100 years old. Adolescence as a unique stage of life.
Yeah.
It was named as a unique stage of life only about 100, around the turn of the century. Right. The privatization of religion since the Enlightenment. So that's been around a little longer, right? But you see it in American religion. You see it very easily in American religion mm-hmm. today. It's very powerful, mm-hmm. right? The Jesus and me way of thinking about it. So young people are experiencing this dissonance in their lives, and we think they're just trying to figure out their own sense of identity. Like, who am I? We think everything. We assume the adolescent is egocentric, self-centered, only worried about him or herself, not interested in the things of the world. I would strongly disagree with that. I think young people are deeply concerned about the world and don't know what to do about it. So it's a vocational crisis, right? I have so much compassion for this world and want to do so much for this world, and I don't know what to do. And that creates dissonance and angst when you feel powerless, right? When you sense a call and don't know how to live it out. So how do we as a Christian community create practices that help young people learn how to act on what the Spirit is calling them to do in their communities? So our limited understanding of adolescence prevents us from seeing that as a call outside of themselves. We think they're just working out their own internal sense of identity. But maybe what they're longing for is affinity and meaning and purpose. So vocation is to the adolescent as public church is to private religion. Okay, so if we have this limited understanding of adolescence, then what we need is a vocational understanding. If we have a limited understanding or private expression of religion, then what we need is a public church, a church that's finding ways to be public, express its faith artistically, through arts, through service, through ritual, out in public spaces, in relationship with the community that they're in. So how does a congregation begin to accompany, that's what we talked about yesterday, and listen to its community with its young people, for the sake of its young people? The way a lot of youth ministry happens now is you purchase a curriculum, right, and you implement the curriculum. That's the way a lot of youth ministry and children's ministry happens. You purchase a curriculum, you implement the curriculum. What I'm trying to say is, I don't think we need curriculum. Sorry, Gary. I think what we need is congregations that are prayerfully, with a biblical imagination, accompanying their context and listening and looking for what God might be doing in those places and finding those things that God's doing and calling that incarnation and calling that the presence of Christ at work in this battered women's shelter, where we see reconciliation and suffering and healing and hope all at the same time here in this place. So how do we help our young people, rather than thinking that we have to somehow insert God's message into their life so that they can then go live it, how do we go looking for what God's already doing and use God's story that we already know as a way of helping us decode what God's doing today in our world. So this is just my little one sentence definition of what I'm trying to talk about. And I was told today I'm kind of selling myself short by talking about it only as youth ministry, because really what we're talking about is just a different way of being church. But I don't want to lose the fact that we do this for the sake of our young people. I get kind of choked up when I talk about this stuff. I apologize. So this is my one sentence definition of public youth ministry. It's an intergenerational faith community seeking to engage its context and express its faith in public and constructive ways. Rather than turning the lights on and hoping people show up, how do we go out there with what we already know about God, with what we already hope for, and look for it? How do we go out there and look for the stuff we talk about on a weekly basis? It doesn't mean the way worship has to go away. So there are five art farms that I'm talking about this week that I think enable communities to do this. One is accompaniment. How do we walk with and listen to and engage a context deeply? How do we know our neighborhood? That's what we talked about yesterday. Today we'll talk about biblical imagination. How do we begin to understand God's story and live into God's story in a way that it changes the way we interpret reality? Reflective practice. Simply, I think about the experiential education wheel, the practical theology wheel, the critical pedagogy wheel, if any of those that you might be familiar with. How do we engage in an experience and think about it theologically? And then how do we change our practices based on what we've seen and what we've thought about? And then how do we engage, re-engage for the sake of the neighbor? Always, this reflective practice, always focused outward towards the neighbor. And then contemplation, how do we dwell in time and in space and listen for this call from God? How do we do that together? And then ritualizing. I see the Narnia children come out and wave to the bus as it leaves, right? So how do we mark space and mark time in public with our kids around things that really matter for them? So these are the art forms we'll be talking about this week.
I got a question.
Yes, sir.
Going back to the curriculum.
Yeah.
No, but I think it's kind of the concept from a congregation that when they hire a youth minister, they're saying, okay, let's develop a curriculum. Mm-hmm. Let's develop, we want you to focus inward. We want you to focus in on our youth. And then many times I see, sometimes people say, well, I've got to spend time either buying it or writing it.
Right.
And I think that's just, everything is so contextual. You know, to spend time for somebody to sit and write and go through this kind of a model of things. I've always said, I love our Ogden Fort of Resources. Mm-hmm. It's always, though, about relationships.
Yeah.
And it's relationship-driven in terms of youth. It's relationship-driven with a congregation in the world. Mm-hmm. And you've got to get, away, you know, yet resources are important.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to contextualize them. But it's relationships.
Yeah.
And I always want to see somebody building relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially with the youth, because I always say, you know, if youth are in trouble, they're not coming to their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the adolescent age. They are not going to come to their parent and talk to them. They better have a trusted, safe person in that congregation to go to. Because either they're going to their peers, but something in life is going to go on, and they're going to have to come to somebody. And they better have that strong relationship. And so that's why I always try to say, yeah, let's focus there. But in one sense, my wife's, you know, went through high school. They're busy as all get out. You know, they're saying, well, what are you going to do in life? What are you thinking of? Or if you're involved in sports, you know, it's in the Twins. I mean, everybody's involved in sports, and they're running over here, or hockey practice, and all that other kind of.
Yep.
These kids are just wiped out.
Right.
And so by the time you even get them into a congregation or that, I mean, they need a Sabbath is what they need.
And
so I like the focus of going, you know, in a sense, yeah, to say, hey, we need to, you know. So.
When I, in 2000, I left one church and moved to a different church in Valparaiso, Indiana. Martha was one of the people at that church. And I might pick on her more as we go through this, but and I realized that when I got there, I walked into this. At that point, youth ministry was really all about leadership development. You know, you need to develop leaders.
Yeah, right.
And I got to Valpo, and I saw a bunch of young people who already were leaders, and they were exhausted. You know, they were exhausted from being leaders. And they would show up on Sunday evenings in their pajamas. They'd come in with their fleece blankies, these high school kids. You know, and I interpreted that as pure exhaustion, you know, and that what they wanted was space. So we did a lot of contemplatives. You know, our curriculum was Lectio Divina and the awareness examen. Those are the only two things we really did with our high school kids in 4 years I was there.
Wow. Good.
And so then to pick on Martha now. Martha's in seminary now, and was leading a group at a homeless shelter that's associated with the church she's connected to in the Twin Cities. And she was doing those practices with the residents at the homeless shelter in Minneapolis, too. So what I realized when I got to this place was that they needed space to just exist and to hear and experience God's grace, you know. And then we worked out the leadership stuff as we went. But I think you're right. Our young people are extremely busy, extremely exhausted. So let me just, I was reading Jaber Crow by Wendell Berry a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't help, when I read this passage, I couldn't help but think about the church. This, actually, he wrote this about the little school and the community he's writing about, this fictional community. Jaber Crow is the barber in this community, and he spends a lot of his day just observing the town. And early in the book, he writes this description of the school. But everywhere where he says school, I pulled out school and put in church. Okay? So let me just read this to you. To walk past the church while it was in session was like coming near a sleeping large animal. You could hear the enclosed murmurs and rustlings of an intense inward life, belonging, it seemed, to another world, whose absence from the town made it seem otherworldly. While the children were in church, the town seemed abnormally quiet. The quiet by mid-afternoon would sometimes seem almost entranced. And so I loved especially the time of day when church let out. What the will of the neighborhood had managed to pen up all day in something like order would all of a sudden burst loose and stream out both ways along the road. What do you hear in that little phrase? I'm taking liberty with Wendell Berry. Of course, he was talking about school.
Well, that another world or other worldliness, I mean, I think that we're called to be in this world and not to be something other.
Mm-hmm.
So for that church to seem separate from the world seems to not be doing.
Mm-hmm.
The writer's outside.
Say more.
Yeah, well, the writer wasn't inside.
He wasn't in the space.
Yeah,
okay.
And didn't feel like he was gonna be either. Didn't sound
yeah.
like
yeah.
kind of liked it out there.
Sure, sure.
And then the life that comes when the people burst out of the building,
yeah.
out into the neighborhood.
Right. Well, we tend not adult society, which drives our culture, really doesn't like that disorder. We don't like that crazy chaos. Oh my gosh, they're playing frisbee on a incline with a stony gutter running through the middle of it, and this is, oh, I just can't watch this, right? And we just don't like the chaos and the noise, and we try to order it, you know. And in our well-intentioned attempt to order what can't be ordered, we've created, I would say, as a church, we've created this sleeping large animal that's really of no use. So how then do we start to think about church in this way, as letting, you know, a lot of youth work for the last century was driven by this whole idea of the need to get our young people off the streets, right? Well, how do we get them back on them? How do we get them back on to the street with the biblical imagination, with the theological reflection, to be able to see incarnation, proclaim good news, release to the captive? How do we empower our young people to do this? How do we do this with them? So that's what we'll be talking a little bit about. And this is the Ezekiel text that we're working through. So we used little Jaber Crow, and now we'll use a little Ezekiel. So I'll read through these verses and then I'll launch into what we're going to do. Then he brought me back to the entrance, and this is also the text that was preached on so wonderfully last night, right? So you're steeping yourself in this now, which is great. Then he brought me back to the entrance of the temple. There, water was flowing from below the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east, and the water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. Then he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me round on the outside of the outer gate that faces towards the east, and the water was coming out of the south side. Going on eastwards with a cord in his hand, the man measured 1,000 cubits and then led me through the water, and it was ankle deep. Again he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, and it was knee deep. Again he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, and it was up to the waist. Again he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not cross, for the water had risen. It was deep enough to swim in, a river that could not be crossed. And he said to me, "Mortal, have you seen this?" I think of a lot of youth ministry is finding the right question to ask at the right time. That's a damn good question right there, pardon my French, right? Mortal, have you seen this? Just the river, the mercy, the width and breadth and depth of the mercy of God flowing out of the temple. As we quickly forget how powerful God's work in the world is. Then he led me back along the bank of the river. As I came back, I saw on the bank of the river a great many trees on one side and on the other. He said to me, "This water flows towards the eastern region and goes down into the Araba, and when it enters the sea of stagnant waters, the water will become fresh." So this is my launching off point, because I want us to think about God's water, God's story, and our story, maybe the stagnant waters, mixing and becoming fresh. So this is using this text to launch into what we're talking about. How then do we think about these stories, these waters, intermingling and mixing and becoming fresh? How do we begin to hear the story of our young people, of a young person, not young people in general? You all have someone in mind, I'm sure. How do we begin to hear that person's story so well And how do we begin to hear God's story so well that those become fresh, mixed, right, and fresh? What does this mean, biblical imagination? Gustav Wingren is a Swedish theologian who I like, and everyone always makes fun of me for liking him, because he's just, I guess, a little more obscure than other theologians Lutherans like to use, but I really like this guy. One thing I really like about him is what was called his twofold phenomenological orientation. I know it's a mouthful, right? But you've heard the saying, when you prepare a sermon, you should prepare with a Bible in one hand and the newspaper in another. You should read the Bible with the newspaper in it. You maybe have heard that. And what Wingren would say was that it's not as linear as that. That you can't just use the Bible to interpret reality, because reality has already affected the way you interpret the Bible. If that makes sense. Right? You can't just use reality to interpret the Bible, because the biblical narrative has already influenced the way you understand reality. So that these two things, our story that we live and experience and God's story that we know in our heart and in our minds, are so intertwined that they're always influencing the way we interpret the other. That is the approach I prefer to take to this. It's complex. It's not linear. It would be nice to say, well, first you read the Bible, and then you go out and you talk about, what you see. But it doesn't always work that way, because you come into the text with an experience that's influencing your read of the text. So what we're talking about is finding practices or art forms. I prefer art form because, if you say your name is
Brian.
So if Brian says he's a painter, and your name is
Judy.
Judy says she's a painter, they might paint in very different ways, right? He might spray paint train cars, right? And you might do watercolors, landscapes, right? But they're still both painters, right? They still paint. It's an art form. But they find their way that they do it. So I prefer art form, because then it lessens the anxiety, right? People start to say, what's the right way to do this? And I would say the right way to do it is the way that works in your setting with your gifts and your people. So the art form that we're looking for is a way to hear, maybe see if this makes sense, to hear young people, to hear them into God's story. What does that mean? To hear a young person into God's story.
Involves listening to what they say about themselves, and then thinking about how that relates to what we know about the biblical stories.
And helping them think about the way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love how it suggests that there's need be no proving on their part that they're in the story. You just need to listen.
Hear.
You need to hear.
Yeah.
How they are.
Yeah.
And that word "into" suggests a pulling in or a drawing in that maybe can best happen when you really hear.
It's not necessarily telling them how they're in God's story.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I like that the adjective "hearing" as opposed to like showing them or.
Well, yesterday Paul was reading from the Message, mm-hmm. and in this text, Eugene Peterson translated it as "Son of Man." And so I'm thinking, "Son of Man, what is he using that?" Well, then here it is, more. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, "Holy man!" Because I'm thinking, "Son of Man." Well, boy, there's a real theological term. I know Peterson's right in trying to keep it at a higher level, but then come back and hear it's even
mortal.
Mortal. Uh-huh. So how did so it's kind of another way to engage mm-hmm. the biblical story. Mm-hmm. So it kind of depends on, God's story told in a different way. It's not the reality like you were talking about a newspaper, but it's a different way of God's story, hearing God's Yeah, and then what's going to happen, you know, down the road as the waters kind of increase.
Yeah.
And that. So it's kind of, but it's also then different texts. Where are those kind of texts that you normally don't hear this?
Absolutely.
You know, that's another thing, or where you can really dig in deeper into a specific text over a given period of time.
Right, because any given text might say nothing to you one day until something happens, and then you go back to that text for whatever reason, and now it says something completely different.
And now this text has huge context for
right.
The whole village just because of what's happening as well.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, great. Last night was a great example of this, I think, right? Ted.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Ted hearing the village into God's story, right? Ted hearing God's story into the village's experience, right? That happened last night at Vespers. So that's a great example. So, and I have a story, too, that I like to tell. And I like to tell because, not to brag, but because... because it really is a good example of what we're talking about. So I teach general religion classes, too, at Augsburg College, not just youth ministry, which means every student has to take this class I teach, which is good and bad, mostly good. And Augsburg's student body is incredibly diverse for a Lutheran college. And we also have a really strong program for students in recovery. Students who are in a 12-step program can live on campus in a sober 12-step program while they take classes. And those are, I would say, the most amazing students to have in Religion 100, right? Because they're studying religion with a sense of urgency that the other students just don't have. It's really life and death for some of them. Some of them see it as life and death. I need to find this higher power quickly or I might not make it till tomorrow, you know. And so one of these students was in my class this last fall. We'll call her Ruth. She was a Jewish woman in recovery. And the first day of class, we were introducing ourselves and talking about our connection to religion. And so Ruth introduced herself, and she said, "But I'm Jewish, but I'm a bad Jew." And I said, "Well, why are you a bad Jew?" And she's like, "Well, I don't always really know if there is a God. And on the days I do think there is a God, I'm just yelling at him." I'm like, "Well, that sounds like a pretty good Jew, actually." You know. And then she talked about, you know, her addiction. And she just basically said, you know, I spend on, you know, if I'm ever talking to God, I spend most of my time fighting with God. And I asked her if she knew what the definition of what the word Israel meant, right? And she didn't know. And so, what does the word Israel mean? Is there,
wrestling.
Yeah, yeah. The one who wrestles with God, right? It's not the one who's got it all figured out. It's very chill.
It's a U.S. Air Force out of Whidbey Island. They're not supposed to do that.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks for the reminder. So she didn't know what the word Israel meant. And so for her to find out that it meant the one who wrestles with God, not the one who has it all figured out, was like, she's like, "You're kidding me, really?" "Yes, that's what Israel means, the one who wrestles with God. The one who yells at God, right? The one who struggles with God." And this was good news for Ruth. Good news for her. Right, and so we kind of close. It was kind of a powerful experience in class. We wrap up class. They come back the next week on Tuesday, and I start class by saying, "How have you encountered religion over the weekend?" And Ruth raises her hand, and she says, "I got Israel tattooed on my body over the weekend because it was such a meaningful experience for me." You know, so then I'm like, you know, all pompous and proud, and I said, "I just hope you are all tattooed with wise things I say by the end of this time." And she said, "I'd show you where it is, but I don't want to pull down my pants." And I'm like, "Guess we don't want you to pull down your pants either." And someone said, "Well, where is it?" And she said, "It's on my hip."
Oh. And was her hip out of joint?
No. But she didn't know the rest of the story. So I said, well, let me tell you the rest of that story. And she broke down, just fell apart and had to leave the room. Of course, my goal was not to make her cry, right? But she heard herself, she experienced herself being heard back into this story, right? So in my tenure process this year, I was asked to try to define the gospel. What is the gospel and how does it affect your teaching? And I could not, I know, that was what was going on in my head. And I told that story because that was the only way I could think of, the best way I could think of in the last year to describe how the gospel impacts my teaching. And how I want the gospel to impact the way we talk and know our young people. How do we hear them back into the story that so many of them feel dismembered from, not a part of? So how do we start to hear them back into it, even if it's sort of tragic? So I'm going to skip over why it's important, because I think we all agree it's important, okay? Okay. For the sake of time, I just want to talk a little bit about, get right down to it, how do we practice this? So, of course, the first thing, how would we practice this? Well, first, we have to know the narrative as a communication, right? And the truth is, we don't. We might know biblical stories, we might know parables, we might know verses, but most Christians don't have a good sense of the overall biblical narrative. Right? So the first, maybe not the first thing, but one step towards this is learning the biblical narrative as a congregation with our young people, with our youth, with our children. So I'll give you some ideas on how you might do this in a minute. Okay, so, yeah, right, I know, I'm at Holden Village, right? I probably don't even need to show this. But Dan Allander's Manna and Mercy, someone here is familiar with it, would someone tell the rest of us what this is?
Brief history of God's unfolding promise to men. It's used as a textbook at Luther Seminary.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they use it there. And then Alan Story, who was here last week, has written done a blog. I think it's and on Manna and Mercy. It's just available on the internet, but it's about he said 100,000 words.
Wow.
Of the whole focus of that.
Right.
And so it's used in a general biblical classes coming to seminary.
Yep, and it's a great way to get the overall narrative, and it takes this idea of manna, and just uses that as the thread through the entire biblical narrative.
Jeremy, can I give one other plug?
Yes, Jeremy.
And that is that, well, Alan is also recording snippets that can be used in education, and he's working with Tom Witt to create a website where churches can share how they're creatively using this and collecting curriculum.
Great.
So if your church is using it, let us know, let me or Chris, and we can connect you with that.
And my hunch is you'll find this in the bookstore here.
It's right beside the register.
Yeah.
So people like it here, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and it's great. We
Dan just left. Yeah, he was here.
Okay, great. And I use this in my Religion 100 class too. So Ruth, who I just talked about, has read this. So another resource is Crossways, and these are just a few. There's many, 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 but these are just a few that I've seen be really successful. Has anyone ever done anything with Crossways? Yeah.
No, our youth pastor does. Do some of this, but
okay.
We haven't.
You haven't done it? Okay, but your congregation uses it. Just another, Crossways is another, I mean, it's dense, right? And it's as dense as you want it to be. It can be really accessible in short sessions, or it can be like a three-year-long curriculum. But by the end of it, you know the biblical narrative by the end of this curriculum. So that's another resource that I've seen congregations use and have a really positive experience with. Our Savior's Lutheran Church congregation I was worshiping at, a congregation I'm a member of, in Minneapolis, does godly play with their children? Has anyone else ever experienced godly play? Yeah. Sam, you're a storyteller, right? Are you a storyteller?
I'm a storyteller.
You're a storyteller.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our church in Van Oregon, it's a Presbyterian church.
You use godly play? Yep. And so this is, you know, play theory, educational theory of play, and some Montessori, I think, technique is woven into this curriculum for young children for, and again, it's not even really a curriculum. It's just simply, yeah, it's visually telling the story and allowing kids to just play with the story. So from an early age, the kids are learning these stories. Couple professors from Luther Seminary are working on something called the Narrative Lectionary, and simply just trying to rethink the biblical texts we use in worship so that they flow more along the line of the biblical narrative, rather than the way they're organized right now. And I Working Preacher, mm-hmm. Is that where it's at?
That, you find it through Working Preacher.
.org.
Correct.
Workingpreacher.org would get you to the Narrative Lectionary material. So these are just some ways. I thought I had one more. That comes later. These are just some ways that your congregation can begin to learn the biblical narrative. It takes a long time, right? It takes a long time.
Can I throw a plug in?
Please, yeah.
Through Book of Faith, if you've been using that from the ALCA, when we started out with the whole Book of Faith resources, it became very clear that people just didn't know the whole story. So editorially-wise, at Godward Fortress, we came up with some things called The Greatest Story, which is 16 sessions, a resource that incorporates Joe Castillo, who's a sand artist, if you've seen any of that. Mm-hmm. So that's one that's a biblical story. Then we came out with Greatest Story Jesus, and now we just come out with Greatest Story Paul by Sarah Henrich at Luther. So those are some other 16 session mm-hmm. courses that you sand artistry mm-hmm. of trying to get very evident that that those people, the congregation, doesn't know the whole mm-hmm. narrative.
Other ideas that folks have that they've helpful source resources they've discovered.
The Grand Suite, I think it's a Methodist
okay.
Study. It's very good.
Okay.
And the Disciple curriculum from the Methodist as well is an intensive in the form of Old Testament, New Testament.
For any age? Could be.
I don't know for sure. I would say I would say at least older youth and adults.
Sure.
I don't know if it goes to younger.
Sure. So much of what we do with young people in particular is issue focused, you know, or topics, and so we never. So it's really disjointed. There's never this biblical narrative that they don't generally get exposed to a biblical narrative. So the first thing I would say is to know the narrative as a congregation. Next, I would say you have to know the young people's stories. How do you do that?
Ask them.
Talk to them, ask them, listen. Really, like, you know, I could do 9 months up here on just number two here, right? But as I sit and think about what kind of church I want for my children, I have a 9-year-old, a 5-year-old, what do I want for them? I want number two. I want a group of people who know my kids, mm-hmm. who want to know my kids, and who want to hear their story and know their story and be a part of that story. That's what I want, selfishly. So then, of course, I'm going to assume that's what everyone wants. And this is hard work. This is really hard work. And it takes a long time to develop that trust, to show that interest. And our assumption of our assumption is that the young people don't want us around, but I think that's wrong. That they do want us around. A friend of mine who does a lot of youth ministry consulting work tells a story about working with a congregation that wanted him to come in, right, and help them figure out what to do with their youth. So they had the adults upstairs and the kids downstairs, and he was sort of running back and forth between these two rooms, working with them at different times. And what he kept hearing from the kids is that the adults are afraid of us. They don't want us around. They're afraid, right? And then when he would go to the adults, he would hear the adults say, the kids are afraid of us. They don't want us around. We really want, but both groups were saying, but we really want to be with them. They're afraid of us, but we really want to be with them. But they just weren't saying that to each other, right? So here he's the mediator running back and forth. And so we, our limited understanding of the adolescent forces us to think that they would rather just be sowing their wild oats, right? But a vocational understanding of adolescence recognizes that what they really want is to be a part of a called community that's living out what it deeply believes in meaningful ways. Third practice is something called Word on the Street, which is something I've had a lot of fun with. This is the book that I came from. I've used this in class a lot to teach students the effect of context on reading a text. So you give them a text to read, and then they read it in three different locations, right? So I would have them, this is really kind of fun, I have them read it in the city center, downtown Minneapolis, outside the government center, while Occupy Minnesota was going on. I didn't plan it that way, it just, of course, happened that way. So one student was reading the text at Occupy Minnesota, and the mayor of Minneapolis came and sat next to him and started talking to him about what he was doing and gave him an apple. So he sat and had an apple with the mayor of Minneapolis and told him about this assignment he was doing. And then he had to read the same text at another location and then at the Mall of America. So he did this all in one day down the light rail in Minneapolis. And then he got to the Mall of America, and he chose to sit at a children's, it was near Halloween, so it was like a children's costume competition. So the kids were prancing across the stage in their costumes, and he was sitting there, this young, you know, urban hipster college kid sitting in the back taking notes at this children's costume competition. And when he got up to leave, he was surrounded by mall security. Oh, yeah. Who took him away for questioning because they were suspicious of him sitting there watching this children's costume competition. Oh, so he's like, I'm doing an assignment for my youth ministry class. So anyway, word on the street is this practice of reading the same text in three different locations and beginning to understand how the text influences your way of viewing the context and how the context influences your way of understanding the text. You can do this anywhere. I mean, if we read this Ezekiel text up on the glacier, you know, and then in the village, and then at the dock, it might change the way we think about the text. So Word on the Street is another great practice, another way to do this. And then fourth, Lectio Divina. Is anyone unfamiliar with Lectio Divina? Is anyone? Okay, great. I'm happy to explain it. Lectio Divina is an old practice of reading Scripture prayerfully. So it's not an academic, heady way of reading the text. Therefore, it's accessible, really, I would say, to anyone. My kids, I can do it with my 5-year-old, you know. The first step is simply listening to the text. So I have trouble doing Lectio on my own, so I need someone else to read it to me out loud. So that's the only way I can do it. Some people can do it on their own. But for me, I like to hear someone read the text slowly to me a few times, and I just simply listen to it. And I listen... I listen for a word or a phrase that seems to, for whatever reason, be grabbing me that day. Particular word, particular phrase that seems to be grabbing me that day. Then after I've heard that word or phrase, after a few times of reading it, then I spend some time in silence pondering this question, how might this word be a prayer for me today? So I was nearing the end, I was nearing the beginning of another programmatic year in the church. The text was, I can't remember the text now. I think it was the Jesus calling the disciples down by the river. I can't recall, but the word that grabbed me was again. I think it was Jesus calling the disciples. They were down by the river again. Maybe it was with John. They were down by the river again when Jesus came walking by and John said, follow him. So that word again struck me, and I realized the way I was feeling about this upcoming ministry year was, I got to do this all over again? I got to do this again? I got to find confirmation teachers again? You know, I have to work with ninth graders again, you know? And so this word became sort of a lament for me, right? So I heard this word, surprised me in that way, and it became a prayer for me that day. This word again, doing... And then you have a chance to respond, where you share, and you might do this, and this is what we would do it with our young people. When we would do this, they had a chance to talk with one another about what was the word, what was the phrase they heard, and how is it a prayer for them today. They would spend most of their time together just doing that. That you might they might want to express that artistically, so there might be ways to paint it or spray paint it, or act it out or sculpt it. So finding interesting ways to help young people express what they're hearing through this way of reading scripture. And then at the end, you simply give thanks for this time, for this moment in time of prayer and enlightenment and of grace. So this doesn't necessarily teach you the biblical narrative, but it helps young people begin to see how scripture might speak to them today. So, for the sake of time, we only have 5 minutes. I wanted to put you into groups, but why don't we just do this all together? I don't care what you do, all these ideas I just shared with you, what I do care is that your congregations find ways to begin to hear young people into the biblical narrative and begin to hear God's story into their lives. How do you see that happening in your church, or how might you hope it will happen in your church? Do you have ideas? Do you have things you hope could happen or maybe are happening? Yes.
Years ago, we had what we called prayer partners, and we would, somebody would organize it, and they would put an adult with a child, and usually the adult knew who the child was, and the child did not know which adult it was, and so we would pray for each other, and sometimes leave little notes in a set of pockets that was made for that purpose, just little notes, and then at the end at a specific time. So that we didn't have to do this forever, we would be given each other. Those children that I did that with, and about 5 of them in our congregation, are all grown now, and they still hug me in church, and they still go to church.
Yeah.
And I find that quite interesting, because now I find myself paying a lot of attention to the little tiny ones.
Mm-hmm.
I learn their name.
Mm-hmm.
I speak to them every Sunday. I pay lots of attention to those kids. And I can see them, you know, coming along. It's just so much fun.
Absolutely. We saw that at Eucharist on Sunday night, right, when the village pastor,
Scott,
thank you, invited the children to come up, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And my 9-year-old son came back and sat next to me and leaned over. He said, "That bread smells really good." So, you know, and they invite the kids to come. And then when he communed them, he got down and looked them in the eyes, right?
Yeah.
So it's little things like that, and it's bigger things like what you did, where you commit a long period of time to praying for and knowing these kids.
It was about 3 months.
Yeah.
That we did it.
Yeah.
Not longer than that, because
yeah, but you just said they're grown up and you still care about them, so
I
it wasn't just 3 months.
Yeah.
It was much more than 3 months.
Well, yeah. But just the secret was for that one.
Yeah.
One other time, somebody did something for 2 weeks. We had a half of a heart, and they were cut out in different ways, and then we had to find the other half.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to look for the child that had the other half,
mm-hmm.
And then we got to the, and that was Valentine.
Sure.
And that was fun too.
Yep.
It was just
yep.
a one-time little thing,
yep.
And yet it made us look at the kids,
yep.
and it made them appreciate us.
Absolutely.
You know.
Tell us again, the children, were they doing any praying for the umbrella?
Yes, they
did
were
they
doing praying for the adults.
They
the Sunday school or the church school person was the person in charge of it, and she was the one who had the idea. And so she taught the children to pray for all the adults of the church at the time, because they knew that it was an adult, but they didn't know who.
Okay.
So it made the children look at us just to think, who is it? Which one of you is it? You know, so they had to pay attention to us. And of course, we were paying lots of attention to the one that was ours.
Sure.
So it's really an experience that's fun to do.
Mm-hmm. What did you put into a pocket somewhere?
Oh, a little. I got a magnet for my refrigerator,
mm-hmm.
and this was at the end. And seemed to me like I can't remember what I did. I think it was a candy bar or something. Probably not appropriate, but something. Well, and then we watched the kid, you know, and so we knew what they liked and what they were like and how old they were, and so we could do things appropriately.
I think one of the big challenges is that needs is exactly this idea. We have this idea at our church about the youth group.
Yes.
And so, maybe the youth group would like to come to the greening movement meetings. Maybe the youth group would like to paint the church.
Yeah.
The youth group is my two kids and another boy and another girl who can only come every other week when she's at mom's and
right.
dad's. Right.
yeah.
And it's just baffling to me. It's like, but that's... They're not, that's not who's here. That's the youth group of the 1950s of your experience,
right.
or the youth group of your imagination.
Right.
It's not who's here now.
Right, and that's why I think someone pointed out to me that what we're really talking about here is not just a different way of doing youth ministry, but a different way of being church, right?
I think
so.
So
youth group is no more. And how do we, you know, how do we... What I say is, how do we engage all young people within reach,
uh-huh.
and know them? Even the kid who, you know, is just rides his bike past our house every afternoon. That never goes to our church.
One of the things we did was have a retreat, a church retreat, where we really reached out and made an effort to include families and make it affordable, and that, you know, was about a third of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
But that helped us feel like a community with
mm-hmm.
the children, knowing more adults
mm-hmm.
in the group and feeling more comfortable in the church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
That was very successful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's after 12,
it's
I just want to say that, but if you need
to
go, feel free to
say another story. There's a woman that was in the Audubon Society that was there that got me into the Audubon Society through my daughter, Laura, who was right up there. And she treated all of the adults exactly like they were children. We would take trips, we'd stand around trees and talk about trees and birds and flowers and stuff like that. She treated everybody the same, like they were about 6 years old.
Sure.
And it worked well.
Well, that's isn't that interesting? But
it was more fun.
Yeah. And okay, so, and who's worship who is worship designed for? Not 6 year olds.
No,
right?
Actually in the Episcopal Church.
So anyway, I hope you just keep thinking about this. How do we walk around the village and our world with a biblical glasses on? Thank you, guys.
Thank you.